We're talking with Ross Coulthart, investigative reporter, who is live with us on the phone from Down Under in Australia, where he is a national figure. He's turned his incredible talents toward the UFO mystery and has overturned a lot of rocks looking for information and sources to try to get to the bottom of this. One of the names that he came across in the course of his investigation is that of Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell was the sixth man to walk on the moon. He was brilliant and brave, a brilliant scientist and explorer, and he had an intense interest in this topic. I was privileged to meet him at NIDS back in the mid-90s. He was one of the science advisory board members. I got to meet him and get to know him and interview him as well a couple of times over the years, and he had some interesting things to say. Perhaps the most interesting thing he had to say was never made public, and it's something that Ross was able to squeeze out of his sources. We're going to hear that story and about the paper trail, some of the documents that he was able to uncover regarding the UFO mystery right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Ross, there's so much I want to cover. I want to start here, though. Edgar Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell was an amazing man, brave and brilliant, sixth man to walk on the moon. But he kept some secrets. You know, there's been a lot of discussion in the UFO world about the Wilson-Davis memos, which we can get to in a moment. But you were able to confirm a story about Dr. Mitchell, something, a story that he never told in public, at least as far as we know. Can you share that with us now?
Yeah, well, this is what really got me into writing this book, George. It was around about, I think it was in the middle of 2019, and the first stories were starting to emerge about the existence of this so-called Admiral Wilson memo. And I think Grant Cameron out in Canada had basically done a story talking about the fact that there were these leaked notes written by a guy called Dr. Eric Davis recording his meeting with, allegedly, with Admiral Tom Wilson, who was the former director of the DIA. And I heard that Grant had got those notes from a guy in Melbourne called James Rigney, who's an architect in Melbourne. And James has a passion. He started out not so much as a ufology person. He was passionate about the wonderful period of American exceptionalism where you guys just did brilliant things, sending missions to the moon. You know, the whole series of Apollo moon missions were, for little boys like me and James, it was the most exciting thing that happened in our lives. It was the moment in history where I think I was 7 or 8 years old in 1969 when the Apollo 11 moon mission landed on the moon and man walked on the moon. And I can just remember that incredible sense of excitement that I felt as a kid, knowing that while I was looking up at the moon right then, there was a man walking around on it called Neil Armstrong. It just seemed amazing to me. And then through James, I heard about a guy who I can't name and I can't even say where he is because he insists on anonymity, but he has a shrine to the whole Apollo moon mission program. He's a lovely fella, and I use the pseudonym The Spaceman with him. And it turned out that James had procured the Admiral Wilson memo from the spaceman, who'd given James the opportunity to look through the archive of what turned out, to my absolute amazement, to be Edgar Mitchell's personal archive of highly sensitive, often UFO, UAP-related material. And a lot of the documents that we're still in the process of going through and which I will release eventually were reports from the National Institute of Discovery Science, NIDS, Bob Bigelow's outfit, which you know well, to members of the Science Advisory Board that were being distributed by Dr. Hal Puthoff, to members of the Science Advisory Board, of whom Edgar Mitchell, the great Apollo 14 astronaut, was one. And he sat on that science advisory board, and as a result of his association with that board, he got a lot of the reports from Hal Puthoff that came in through NIDS. And what amazed me was I first approached the spaceman thinking that all I was going to get to see was this Admiral Wilson memo. And I've held the original Admiral Wilson memo in my hands and looked at the document and convinced myself of its provenance. I'm absolutely certain that the document is a real document and that it was sent by probably Hal Puthoff to Edgar Mitchell shortly after the meeting took place between Eric and Avril Wilson in October 2002. And that's significant because I found the document in the archive, which was retrieved from Edgar's estate after he died by his nephew, Mitch Harkins. And it was passed on to the spaceman at Edgar's request. And the archive's quite extraordinary because it shows what the spaceman told me is true, which is that Edgar, all through his life, had far greater interest than he ever cared to admit in what he called the reality of what happened to astronauts on the moon, Apollo moon program. Edgar told the spaceman, and I believe him because of who he is and the associations that he has with some very famous people, top people in NASA, top people in the space program. Edgar told the spaceman that the moon missions, the Apollo moon missions, he believed were followed all the way out, all the way there, and all the way back. And that he saw craft objects while he was on the moon landing mission, Apollo 14. And indeed, I've sat with the spaceman and gone through the videos that Edgar gave him, which a lot of which are official NASA videos. And he's pointed out to me objects that are quite clearly visible on the NASA videos, which show things that Edgar says he could not explain. They were, in some cases, lights that he said he saw with his own eyes. And as Edgar pointed out, there are lights recorded on certain sections of NASA imagery, which were recorded on two separate cameras from positions, notably the lunar module, where there were no lights of that particular color, which could cause a reflection or some kind of refraction that might be the skeptical explanation for what it was that Edgar thought he saw. Edgar says he saw these lights with his own eyes, and that at the point of the docking with the command module of Apollo 14, he says he saw a craft, a very dark craft, hovering very close to the command module as they were doing their maneuver to connect to dock back with the command module after the moon landing. A breathtaking allegation, and I asked the spaceman, I said, why did Edgar keep it secret all his life then? Because Edgar, all through his life, denied that he'd ever seen any kind of UFO, any kind of craft or any kind of anomalous object. And Edgar said one word. He told the spaceman that to talk about what he saw as an astronaut was made very clear to him, it would be an act of treason. Now, I didn't say this. Edgar Mitchell did. And I've since spoken to the spaceman at length, and I am very, very sure, based on the incredible closeness of the association that he had. He was one of Edgar's close personal friends, very, very close personal friend. In fact, after Edgar died, he went to Edgar's house and assisted in the collation of the documents from Edgar's archive. And he actually slept in Edgar's bedroom. That's how close they were. And the family loved him. They cared for him. And he has in his house the most extraordinary collection of Apollo moon landing memorabilia. It is literally a testament to the bravery and the incredible courage of what the Americans pulled off in that decade, in the 1960s, where they did these incredible landings and achieved the moon landing in 1969, right through to, I think it was 1975. Well, I've forgotten the exact date when they all stopped. But, you know, that incredible period. And Edgar says that he spoke to a lot of astronauts, and indeed the spaceman has actually spoken to astronauts. And in my presence, he's spoken to an astronaut, and that astronaut has confirmed that they saw anomalous objects during the Apollo moon missions. They won't go on the record because, as you know, there aren't a lot of them left. But basically, I'm very, very satisfied that Edgar Mitchell took steps in his lifetime to preserve the Admiral Wilson memo because he thought it was historically significant. And he knew that after he died, it would come into the possession of somebody like the spaceman who would nurture it and look after it and make sure it got to the right people. And so when I hear people saying that the Admiral Wilson memo is a forgery, that it's not a true document, that it's a clever document that was created long after 2002 when the meeting allegedly occurred. That is definitely not the case. I have convinced myself based on other documents around that document, and more importantly, the circumstances of the provenance of that document, that it was obtained from Edgar Mitchell's estate soon after he died, and that Edgar came into possession of that document shortly after it was written by Dr. Eric Davis.
Well, I have zero doubt about the legitimacy of that. How, you know, that document has been around. It was closely held for a long time in a small group of people, and it is an accurate reflection of a meeting that really did take place. I am not surprised that Admiral Wilson would deny ever having such a meeting. It's his job to deny if asked. So the implications of what's in the memo, though, that we have crash retrievals, that we have technology that we didn't make, that we're reverse engineering it, trying to figure out how it works, and subsequent sources who are familiar with those discussions say that we haven't made much progress. Where are you on that, on reverse engineering stashed, crashed saucers, metamaterials, things of that sort?
I asked Matt Kobitz, the Navy's former Director of Science and Technology Development, if he could find out for me, and he went away and came back to me about a week later and said that he'd asked very senior people in the US Navy, and they were not aware of any successful crash retrieval program that had re-engineered a craft. But that's inside the Navy, and I have to admit, I'm nervous because I know from other sources that inside the US Navy, there is a lot of ill will towards the US Air Force. And I've just recently learned that Dr. Salvatore Pei, the former scientist who registered the US Navy patents at the Patuxent Navy facility, the Navy Research Facility near Washington, D.C., I've heard that he's left the Navy and is now working inside the US Air Force. Wow. Interesting. That the person that claimed to have been able to develop technologies that essentially would represent anti-gravitic technologies is now working inside the US Air Force. And I've spoken to people inside the US Navy because one of the things I did, I pulled rank as an Australian journalist. And because we've got a pretty good, you know, we've gone to war with you guys pretty much since World War One, George. You know, there's a lot of affection towards Australia in the Pentagon. And so I've got sources that I've spoken to over many years who facilitated introductions to people that probably shouldn't have spoken to me, so they'll remain anonymous in this conversation and others. But they are former senior people, but also serving people inside various three-letter agencies in your government. And a couple of people that I spoke to from your Navy admitted to me that they are not sure anymore that the US Air Force isn't hiding something, and that the depth of animus between the US Navy and US Air Force over the whole issue of the Tic Tac sightings, the gimbal, the GoFast, has got to the stage now where, you know, very senior people in the US Navy are saying they cannot be sure that they're not being lied to when they're told that the United States government is not back engineering or has not successfully back engineered a craft. And that's the only reservation I have, because like you, I've followed people like Dr. Eric Davis, who've told different commentators, including, I think, yourself, that they don't believe that craft have been successfully re-engineered. That essentially what I've been told by people who purport to know about the program and who at one stage or at different stages have or are being involved in different SCI aspects of the program, they said that efforts to re-engineer technology that had been recovered were not successful because of the obsessive secrecy that was attached to the whole issue. They said that, you know, it was one of the things that frustrates good science is not being able to share information, not being able to exchange ideas. And it's interesting because I've spoken to people who purport to have been involved in programs where they were trying to replicate technologies that they believed were non-terrestrial, not of this world. And they were unable to do so, and they were frustrated in their efforts to do so, they believed, because they just were not able to do what scientists like doing, which is share data and share information and compare hypotheses. And that, it has been put to me, is what is frustrating the efforts inside the dark world to replicate this technology.
Let me ask you this. So Tic Tac is now the most famous UFO case in the world, beyond Roswell, I guess, and maybe more so. That video changed everything. It got the public's attention. The UAP task force, as we know, has looked at it. They have information that we do not have, not only about Tic Tac, but about Gimbel and other cases that are part of this briefing document they prepared for Congress, for the Joint Chiefs, for other people inside the Pentagon, intelligence agencies. They have a great deal more information than has been made public. Sensor information from the best sensors, the most sophisticated sensors in the world. And they have the eyewitnesses, the pilots like Dave Fravor, folks like that who are trusted by our government with the highest security clearances. They are trusted to fly these multi-million dollar machines. They have equipment that is beyond anything that's known in the public arena. And yet we have experts, twitfologists, podcasters, bloggers, who every day attack the credibility of people like Dave Fravor, attack the validity of the Tic Tac cases, and assume that because they have a keyboard and can type things on their screen and send it out to the world, that they know way more about these kinds of cases than do does the Navy or the UAP task force. What is your sense on the kind of information that is available to that task force that allows them to say, with a considerable amount of certainty, these are genuine unknowns?
I've had the privilege of speaking to people who are aware of how the task force investigated the 144 incidents that formed the basis of the report that was tendered to the Congress on 25 June. I am in absolutely no doubt that before they reached the conclusion that 143 of those objects were unexplained, they had excluded all of the available prosaic, mundane explanations that you could conceivably think of, be it weather balloons, misidentified aircraft, birds, whatever you'd like to put. There's no adequate explanation that explains what they saw. And I'm told that they've excluded the prosaic explanations that might normally be used, which is why this report to the Congress is so significant, because it admitted that 143 out of 144 of these incidents, these sightings, are unexplained. And look, while I'm on the matter, George, the thing that I find is the moment of cognitive dissonance for me, where people assert that this might be. I noticed there's a recent documentary that has aired on Showtime,
yes,
which has basically asserted that there might be the U.S. Air Force or somebody inside the military might be testing this technology against the U.S. Navy in an undisclosed way. And look, I've spoken to somebody in our Navy in Australia at a very, very high level, you know, almost rear admiral status. And they made their own inquiries and spoke to people they knew in the U.S. Navy. And they came back to me and they scoffed at the suggestion that any other arm of the U.S. military would test this technology without notifying the U.S. Navy, that you would expose thousands of servicemen and women on U.S. Navy boats in an exercise just off the Californian coast, and then not warn these people to shut up about what they saw, not tell Dave Fravor to be quiet about what he saw, not tell Alex Dietrichs to shut up about what she saw. It's absurd to suggest that this was somehow some kind of test exercise where they were testing new technology. Because whatever it is, as so many people have said, as Mitt Romney said, the Republican senator, former presidential candidate, he told CNN that this is not American technology. It's not Russian or Chinese technology. And more importantly, George, it's been around since at least World War II. I mean, I found references in files in Australia to sightings incidents as far back as the 1930s. And I'm aware of incidents that are reported in newspapers in your country right back in the 19th century. And of course, if you want to go back even further, I'm sure you could talk about the biblical references to strange objects doing weird things in our skies. I believe these objects have been around for millennia. And yes, I think we just have to slowly come to the realization.
Ross Coulthart is my guest. I still want to talk to you about the paper trail, particular documents that you've revealed in this book, soon to be released in plain sight. We'll get to that in a moment. You know, UFO world is a strange terrain. You know, there are so many critics. Everyone's a critic. And people love to muddy the waters as much as they can. That includes even those among the UFO faithful, the people who are supposedly true believers. They all say they want the truth, so long as it is their truth, their little slice of turf that they've worked out. So they attack anybody who comes up with a different sort of a take on the subject matter. And if my guest, Russ Coulthart, has not yet been accused of being a disinformation agent or a tool of the deep state, the evil cabal, well, it's something he can look forward to. It'll happen eventually. We're going to continue our conversation in the next segment, try to get one or two calls in and ask Ross about some of the paper trail, the documents that he's uncovered, which really do reflect on how long this mystery has been underway and how deep the cover-up works. We'll be right back. Ross, one of the rabbit holes you've been exploring for a while now is the paper trail. The U.S. government, as you know, concluded as far back as the late 1940s that these things, these UFOs, UAPs, are not fictitious. They're not imaginary. They're real. They're not ours. We don't think they're the Russians. I mean, I've heard people try to explain the recent sightings as Chinese drones, which, of course, the Chinese were not flying Tic Tacs back in the 1940s. There is a paper trail that you explore in your soon-to-be-released book, In Plain Sight. You know, you recognize that Project Blue Book was largely a public relations exercise, trying to explain them all away, all UFO cases. When it ended in 1969, there was a memo written by an Air Force general, wasn't made public until 10 years later, basically said that all UFO cases involving U.S. national security will continue to be handled the way they've always been handled, meaning they were never part of Blue Book, which is why the Air Force could say with a straight face, we have no indications that UFOs represent a possible threat. You found a document that I don't recall ever hearing about before. It's referenced in your soon-to-be-released book, written at the beginning of Project Blue Book, indicating that national security cases involving UFOs get sent to somewhere else, not to Project Blue Book. Do you recall the provenance of that document?
Oh, gosh, George, you're really testing me here.
Oh, I mean, sorry.
I've looked at so many documents.
Yes.
I can tell you, there is a consistent pattern of a cognitive dissonance, if you like, between what the U.S. government was saying publicly through Project Blue Book. You know, you were being told in the American public, you were being told it isn't a national security threat. There is no threat to flight safety. And privately, behind the scenes, it's abundantly clear that the documents in your archives show that there were investigations continuing for, including the retrieval of what sound like flying saucers by different agencies as part of a Project Moondust. These retrievals were going on right through the 1960s and even after the end of Project Blue Book. And one source document that really had a huge influence on me was Professor Harry Turner, who I hope one day there'll be a statue to him, as there should be one day, I think, a statue to Dr. Eric Davis, by the way, and George Knapp. It's going to be a very cluttered corridor. But I think the Professor Harry Turner was a professor of physics in Australia, and he was brought in by the Air Force in Australia to investigate UFOs. And this was back in the 1950s when there was an openness and there was a transparency and a willingness to actually investigate, a bit like their friends the Americans were doing. And Harry was dragooned into the tests of nuclear weapons at a site called Maralinga in South Australia. And he recorded numerous documents in the archives which had gone to the Department of Air Force Intelligence in Australia, which showed that there was a definite link between strange objects, metallic craft hovering over nuclear test sites, and craft that was seen shortly just before or just after nuclear weapons tests flying at ridiculous speeds and doing ridiculous maneuvers. And Harry became very convinced that there was something going on, and he believed strongly that the Americans were lying to the Australian government about what they knew. And the report that frankly leapt out at me the most was the document that he wrote to the heads of essentially the Defence Science Organisation in Australia. And he flatly accused the American government of a cover-up. He said that the Americans were clearly not telling the full story about what they'd seen. And he said that on the basis of the reviews that he'd done, he was absolutely certain that the American government was back engineering craft, that they were in retrieving technology. And this is a guy who had the highest security clearances inside our Defense Department. And he was for a while, he was a very popular fellow because he was one of our top defence scientists. And at one stage, he had people in our Air Force intelligence willing to expend the money on essentially a rapid readiness force to go and investigate UFO sightings and instances where craft were alleged to have landed. But what happened very much around the time that Project Blue Book came to an end was there was this incredible change that occurred where publicly we were all being told UFOs are nonsense, they should be ridiculed, they should be treated with taboo and stigma. Yet privately, behind the scenes, in Australia and also in America, and indeed all around the world, countries were investigating this phenomenon, including, as you discovered, I mean, I think, George, one of the most fascinating areas that I'm dying to get into is Russia. You know, what did the Russians know? And in my research, I learned that you were there probably 30 years before me at the end of the Cold War when you went and interviewed General Sokolov about what he saw in Russia. And this is the thing that leapt out at me as a journalist, is that every country in the world that's got, you know, a reliable Air Force intelligence has tracked and monitored this phenomenon. And every country has been perplexed by it and unable to explain it. But at certain times, a decision seems to have been made to suppress it. And I don't know about you, my friend, but I am puzzled as to why. I don't know why the Russians haven't made political capital out of what they know and what they've recovered. Because as recently as last week, I was having conversations with a very senior official, former military official in Russia, who was telling me about some of the things that they've seen. And it's quite clear that all around the world, countries with the resources to investigate have been uncovering quite extraordinary things. And I'm perplexed as a journalist. That's the mystery I'm trying to get to the bottom of. Why secrecy?
I'm not sure that any government in the world wants to admit to its own public, we don't know what these things are. They fly through our airspace. There's nothing we can do about it. Thank you and good night kind of a thing. They also don't want to admit what they don't know to their adversaries. I think there's a lot of pretense that different governments would allow their rivals or adversaries to believe that it might be them when in fact it's none of us.
Do you think it's as simple as that, though? I mean, I must confess, I was told that by one person who said to me from an Air Force, or your Air Force, they said to me, look, could it not, Ross, be as simple as we just don't like admitting we don't know what it is?
Yeah.
And the problem that I have with that is your Air Force, probably more than any other arm of your military, is transparently involved in an egregious cover-up. And I don't say that lightly. But I do think, you know, the fact that there is a long history of the Air Force Office of Special Investigations frustrating people trying to uncover this mystery.
Well,
the fact that the U.S. Air Force lies at the bottom of the Tic Tac saga, you know, they obviously know more.
There's a name that you mentioned in your book that I would not confirm it other than that you're reporting it. And I think it's been mentioned by a couple other people. It's Dick D'Amato, Richard D'Amato, who was an investigator authorized by Congress, by the Senate, to Intelligence Committee and others to go ahead and investigate whether there's a cover-up and that whether materials, craft, are stashed somewhere, either at places like Area 51 or within private industry, aerospace companies. And I had a lot of conversations with him back and forth for a period of 2.5 years. He said that a reason for the cover-up in this country anyway, would be if it ever comes out and if legitimate national security money has been used to perpetuate a cover-up, somebody's going to go to jail when it comes out. So maybe it's partially a matter of personal survival as a reason for some people keeping this going.
Gosh, I really hope that's not the case, because if I can have a rant for a moment, George, the thing that I most admire about America was that period of exceptionalism where during the Apollo moon mission program, you proved that just about anything is possible. And America can achieve amazing things when it gets its act together, when it stops having a hang-up and a negativity and it basically collaborates and does wonderful things with science. And that's what I grew up with as a child. You know, you looked to America for scientific exceptionalism, for, you know, leadership. And this is the thing that really shocks me about this, that if this is the case, if the US truly has recovered technology like this, I don't know why it's sitting on this secret. I think we should offer immunity to anybody that's suppressed this information. We should get it out there and get the scientists working on it, if that's genuinely the case. And I have to admit, I have a hunch it is. And I find it incredible that I'm saying that to you, because I'm a serious insect journalist who doesn't believe in conspiracy theories. But I really do think that there has been suppression of the most extraordinary secrets inside your government. And so do people in my government. That they are aware that the Americans are sitting on information. I mean, I've spoken to pilots in my military who've told me that they've seen things that they can't explain, that their government can't explain. And the best explanation they come up with is that it's probably Chinese or American or Russian technology, but they know it doesn't wash. So if it's not that, if as Mitt Romney says it's not that, then if as Chris Mellon says it's not that, what is it? And why are we not engaging to study this mystery? Why is there this silly silence? And if I was Joe Biden, I would see this as my new Manhattan Project, my new Apollo moon mission program, and I would demand to get to the bottom of this mystery. And I would find the scientists responsible and the military officials responsible for keeping this secret. And rather than punishing them, I would do what South Africa did after the apartheid. I would have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission where there is a reckoning before the Congress, before your House of Representatives, and I would force them to testify. That's absolutely vital. And it's quite clear from what Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon have been pushing for that that's what they think as well.
Well, as you know, Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon, along with many other people who are involved in moving the ball down the field, are accused of being disinformation agents. You mentioned about that documentary series that's been out. I haven't seen it yet. I'm in it. But I know that it attacks Lou and Chris, Tom DeLonge, Bob Bigelow, Harry Reid. They're all part of the deep, dark plot. And if you're not a part of it yet, Ross, you soon will be. That comes with the territory in UFO world. You know, there's a 70-year document, a paper trail that shows that our military has been very candid behind closed doors. Hey, that's not ours. It's not us. We need to figure this out. We need to study the technology while telling the public something very different. That's what the UAP Task Force report has changed. I mean, it's an admission. Yeah, this is real, and we don't know what it is.
And that's what I tried to achieve with my book, George, because I have to admit, I'd always assumed that there was a completely plausible explanation. I mean, I've operated with your military, and I've seen them up close in combat zones like Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, there are times when your commanders have literally had my life in their hands, and I'm very proud and frankly amazed at what America has achieved in the world. But the fact that your political leadership is so transparently allowing itself to be snowed by glib explanations, a cognitive dissonance between the private and public position, I think it's becoming untenable. And frankly, I just refuse to indulge claims that, you know, people like Chris Mellon and Lou Elizondo are some kind of disinformation front. That's paranoid nonsense. I've spoken to people in my government who've vouched for these people. I've spoken to Special Forces people who knew Lou in Kandahar from the Australian Special Forces, who respected him as one of the top counterintelligence officers in that part of Afghanistan. These are respected people. Chris Mellon, oh my goodness, he's got such a good reputation in Australia amongst our defence officials. He's the guy that put together SOCOM, the Special Operations Command. I mean, the guy is plugged into the defence infrastructure in a way that these people that are making these criticisms just truly do not understand. And I find it perplexing and bewildering as a journalist the way that every time there is a breakthrough in the UFO-UAP mystery, across the hill, like the cavalry, come the idiots who try and undermine breakthroughs and assert that there is somehow some dark force that is, you know, having to be explained that means that these people can't be taken seriously. Ufology eats its own young. It really does. And one of the bits of advice that I got from a preeminent journalist that writes in this area, I won't use their name, but they said to me when I told them I was writing a book, Ross, stay away from UFO Twitter. Stay away from the UFO world because they'll all devour you. And the reality is I want to get on with everybody. You know, frankly, this silly, narky behavior. Journalists are much better at that than ufologists, frankly. I mean, I've been in a world where people shaft each other all the time. So, frankly, I don't really care. But what I think people need to do is focus on the main game. They need to realize that we really are. I mean, it's just incredible what has been achieved in the last 4 years since the incredible reports done by the New York Times, by you, by Tim McMillan, MJ Benias, by Brian Bender. You know, there's a really proud list of people who've broken big scoops. John Greenwald over at the Black Vault. You know, people have broken really important stuff that's important. And we all need to collaborate. I'm a member of a group called ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which is essentially a collaboration of some of the world's preeminent investigative journalists. And frankly, I was a kiddie in a lolly shop. I got to meet Bob Woodward one day in Washington, D.C. at one of these conferences. I met Cy Hirsch, Seymour Hirsch.
Wow.
And, you know, these guys, they are the preeminent journalists of their generation. And it's been such a learning experience for me to collaborate and learn from them and understand how to do investigations properly. And that's what this field needs to learn. It needs to pull together, stop shafting each other, stop playing these silly, pathetic, egotistical games. I mean, I'm not saying this as anybody who really cares, frankly. I'm just saying this as somebody who sits back and watches ufology devour itself. You guys all need to get on, and you need to understand that it's not each other, that people in the Pentagon are laughing when you start shafting each other.
Yeah. I've made the same argument for a long time, and it falls on deaf ears. But I, you know, Colonel Corso, who you mentioned in your book, I knew him before he passed, and he had told me in our first interview 2 years before his book came out that the Pentagon doesn't have to plant disinformation or discredit the topic because ufologists are happy to do that on their own. Ross Coulthart, it's been terrific to talk to you. In Plain Sight is a wonderful piece of work. I can't wait for the American readers to get a look at it. You say at the end, a reckoning is coming, and I think you're right. Thanks so much for joining us. Please stay in touch.
It's an honor, George. Thank you for the time.
Thank you. Thanks also to my earlier guest, Stan Gordon, and to my colleagues there at Coast, Donna Walker, Michael Cosio, Lex Lonehood, Dan Galante, and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next Sunday night. George Norrie is here tomorrow. Good night, everyone.